Hello and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks and the Learning College, where we put things in a white perspective. My name is Alex Linder, and you can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com. Today what we're going to do is Chapter 18. This is going to be a briefer session than the other ones we've had, a half dozen or so. On the Ordeal of Civility, and the chapter on the anthropologist Claude Levi-Strauss. Chapter 18, Claude Levi-Strauss, The Rude, The Crude, The Nude, and The Origin of Table Manners. And it'll be about 151 up to, let's see, I think 162. So yeah, this is going to be about half as long as some of the other ones. But it's on its own, so I think it's best to record it that way. And we'll have about four sessions left after this to complete The Ordeal of Civility, which is 238 pages, long full pages, plus endnotes that we won't have too much to say about. Anyway, let's get started with Chapter 18, Claude Levi-Strauss, The Rude, The Crude, The Nude, and The Origin of Table Manners. Claude Levi-Strauss belongs with the founding patriarchs of Jewish intellectual culture in the diaspora with Marx and Freud. We've already covered Marx and Freud. Structural anthropology is the last of the classic ideological remedies, quote-unquote, for the cultural status wound inflicted on intellectual Jewry by its emancipation into the West. So, he says, okay, just to repeat, Claude Levi-Strauss belongs with the founding patriarchs of Jewish intellectual culture in the diaspora, with Marx and Freud. So that's surprising, he's saying he's on their level. Not Callan or Boas, but Levi-Strauss. He is to anthropology as they are to sociology and psychology. Notice he says sociology for Marx, not economics. Structural anthropology is the last of the classic ideological remedies for the culture status wound. It's not us, it's this universal thing, this universal problem that all humanity has. It's nothing to do with any specific Jewish collective negative. We might appear primitive, but it's just because his revered teacher, Emile Durkheim, believing in historical development, had founded French scientific sociology with his first great work in 1893, The Division of Labor and Society, in which he analyzed the modernization process as a development from tribal or mechanical solidarity, which he illustrated chiefly, as a son of rabbis, by copious Old Testament references. Asterisk. 45 explicit references to Deuteronomy, Exodus, Joshua, Leviticus, Numbers, and the Pentateuch are indexed in the Division of Labor, more than to any other single topic or person. Professor Benjamin Nelson once remarked in a lecture that the index to Max Weber's Economy and Society contained more references to Jews, to Jesus, than to Marx. So, Emile Durkheim, the Division of Labor and Society, 1893, analyzing the modernization process. Back to the main text. From tribal or mechanical solidarity, which he illustrated chiefly as son of rabbis by copious Old Testament references, to modern civil societies, from tribal to modern civil societies in the West, which he called superior societies. It is significant, recalling the old dispute over the word Betterment, remember Dome from last session, or Verbesserung in German, in Dome's title, that the subtitle of the first edition of Durkheim's Division of Labor, namely Etudes sur Organisation des Sociétés Supérieures, Studies in the Organization of Superior Societies, was subsequently dropped. Levi-Strauss experienced such, quote, developmentalism, unquote, as demeaning, much as today in Latin American Marxist intellectuals derisively reject the whole developed-underdeveloped paradigm. We're alternately developed in the backwards direction. Paradigm of modernization by calling it desarrollismo, or more like disarrangement, I think is what that means. Now, I got to look that up because I've seen that word a lot of times and I get it wrong. Desarrollismo. All right, it basically means developmentalism, and it's essentially left-wing. These countries, third world, can't just be raw material resources for the developed world. They need to develop on their own, industrialize themselves. Now, returning to the text. All our teachers, Levi-Strauss recalls, were, quote, obsessed with the notion of historical development. Experiencing the same status wound that would lead later members of the Jewish community to bitterly resent Arnold Toynbee's reference to observant Orthodox Judaism as a fossil, Levi-Strauss, though an unsynagogued, quote-unquote, secular Jewish intellectual, turned decisively against the whole idea of social evolution, even in its modern and relativized form, what is now called the New Evolutionism. His deeply oral imagination, he castigated the cannibal instincts of the historical process, as he would later code myths under the categories of the raw and the cooked, spat out Western civilization and the vaunted meaningfulness of historical experience. My intelligence is Neolithic, he announced. To reach reality, we must first repudiate experience. Sounds to me like rejecting reality because it shows him something he doesn't want to look at. Levi-Strauss attributes this fundamental insight to Karl Marx, who also repudiated appearances, to whom he considers himself to be in pupillary succession. He's the teacher, and Levi-Strauss is the student. Falling back on the anthropological language of initiation, he writes, block quote, when I was about 17, I was initiated into Marxism by a young Belgian socialist whom I had met on holiday. A whole new world was open to me. My excitement has never cooled, and rarely do I tackle a problem in sociology or ethnology, ethnology, without having first set my mind in motion by a reperusal of a page or two from the 18 Brumaire of Louis Bonaparte or the Critique of Political Economy. So a young Jew Marxist. Levi-Strauss, by thus rooting his ahistorical structuralism in Marx, inadvertently unpacks the historicism and idealism at the root of Marxism. Historicist idealism is an ideological strategy used by both the old aristocratic insiders and the new ethnic outsiders for recouping from the status humiliations of modernity. Cultural and subcultural dispossession are a wound in the heart. Embarrassment that they're... All right, now. Historicism is the theory that social and cultural phenomena are determined by history, so I'm having a little trouble understanding here. Marx said it all proceeded in stages, inevitably, scientifically determinable stages, and that economics was the base of it and everything else was the superstructure. So is that historicism? It sure sounds like it. And yet he says that Levi-Strauss is rooting his ahistorical structuralism in Marx, and that inadvertently unpacks the historicism and idealism at the root of Marxism. So we'll just leave it there. Historicist idealism is an ideological strategy used by both the old aristocratic insiders and the new ethnic outsiders for recouping from the status humiliations of modernity. No, you don't know how to dress, you don't know how to act, you don't know how to be, you're just backwards. Those would be the status humiliations of modernity. And more so if they don't need to be said because they're tactful and polite, you just feel them. You're being judgy. You're judging me, you know. Structuralism, like Marxism, is an ideology of subcultural despair, an uneasy melange of cognitive relativism and ethical absolutism. And I guess the ethical absolutism would be you can't judge, you can't say that one culture is more developed than another. That's wrong in an absolute sense. And cognitive relativism would be, I guess, a different way of putting the same thing. I'm a little off here. I've never studied Levi-Strauss or taken a formal class in anthropology. I've just read a fair amount about it, but he is one I'm less familiar with than Marx or Freud, certainly, that I have both formally and informally studied. But I'm not so sure that those two don't mean about the same thing. What they're trying to do, and remember, this is in the same time period as Horace Kallen and the rise of multiculturalism, and the melting pot, Israel Zangwill, they all kind of mean the same thing. The West isn't any better than anywhere else. All cultures are equally valid. The whites in the West have no basis for thinking they're any better. The same thing continues today, 120 years later. They're trying to justify their own backwardness and also the backwardness of the tool peoples they would use, like blacks, etc., in order to destroy white society. That's always the goal. And Murray Cudahy wouldn't say that part, but he would focus more on they're trying to make themselves feel better, seeing how ugly and backward they are, is more what he's saying. So, the component of positivism in Marx, his hard-boiled, hard-nosed materialism, is indeed small compared to the logicism, his contradictions talk, and idealism. It is not for nothing that Talcott Parsons, after briefly analyzing Marx as a part of the positivistic tradition, breaks off his analysis. Further discussion of Marx will therefore be postponed until his relation to idealism can be taken up in chapter 18 of the idealistic tradition. He is one of the most important forerunners of the group of writers to be dealt with under the heading of idealism. The curious paradox of Marxism, which Michael Polanyi has identified as constituting the secret of its appeal, namely skeptical fanaticism, characteristic also of that other product of Jewish intellectual culture in the diaspora, Freudianism, is itself rooted in large part in the fact that Marxism is a theoretical conceit, asterisk, using conceit as it is used in literary criticism, the way Coleridge in Biography Literaria used fancy, pitting it against imagination. Only the latter melds components into a new whole. So Marxism is a theoretical conceit, that is, a violent yoking together of theoretically unmediated components, positivism and idealism. I guess that means sort of the is and should. It is this way. I'm describing scientifically what's going on, but yeah, it should be this way, and it must be this way. We'll make it this way. The secret of its appeal, its skeptical fanaticism. And it's funny how he says yoking together, like yoking doesn't mean putting together. It's like when we say teaming up or banding together. It seems impossible for us not to put it that way, to re-emphasize. Theoretically unmediated components, positivism and idealism. And to be honest, I'm not perfectly sure what he means by that, but I think it's what I described. That he's putting it in the form of saying this is a scientific analysis of history, and it develops by stages based on class contradictions involved in the means of production. As the means of production change, different classes rise to the top, and this is how it's going to end. But it's also basically a religious appeal to it, that it must be like this. It's going to be good. Certain classes can help move it along. And I think he means he's yoking those two things together. Positivism and idealism is how he, what he calls the things it's yoking, which appeals to an intellectual clientele at once cynical about the situation of social action, that's a quote, and utopian about the ends of social action. Thus, the allure of these ideologies for a dissociated theoretical sensibility consists in their appeal to moral passion in the language of social science. In scientific socialism, as in scientific, in quotes, psychoanalysis, the normative and the cognitive are conflated. The fire and the rose are one. A pitilessly punitive and skeptical objectivity unmasks a given world of fact. A homeless revolutionary longing projects a new world of value. A homeless revolutionary longing projects a new world of value. There'll be a different world where we are on top. There's an asterisk after that which says, Jean-Richard Bloch, B-L-O-C-H, in a brilliant essay translated by Lionel Trilling, was the first to identify this subcultural syndrome, what Black calls a, quote, combination of skepticism and fanaticism in the secular intellectual Jews of modernity. Skepticism and fanaticism. Now let's see where we are. So John Richard Block was the first to identify this subcultural syndrome, what Block calls a combination of skepticism and fanaticism in the secular intellectual Jews of modernity. Quote, Napoleon, the Jews, and the Modern Man was the essay in Menorah Journal 18, number 3, March 1930, 219. Text again. Members of the Frankfurt Institute for Social Research, for example, Adorno, Horkheimer, Marcuse, and others, considered their effort to combine elements of Marxism with Freud's psychoanalysis in developing critical theory to be the work of, quote, unattached and, quote, universalistic, quote, unquote, radical intellectuals. The Frankfurt Institute members are famous for their indignant repudiation of all sociology of knowledge attempts to relativize their radicalism by exploring its possible connections with their cultural marginality and ethnicity. So they expressly wish to disclaim and deny that it's because they're Jews and serving a Jewish agenda that they came up with this garbage. But that is, in fact, the case, and that is what is worked out fully in Kevin MacDonald's work. That's where it fits on to here, but here he is, you know, decades before MacDonald pointing this out. But he's not saying they're specifically using it to attack the West, but he's pointing out that they're denying that they are Jews motivated by Jewish concerns. But that is the thing that matters to us, to put all this stuff in a white context, because otherwise it's a bunch of baseless theories. But it only makes sense as part of group strategy to attack the West with many different fronts in the intellectual world as well as the political world. So, members of the Frankfurt Circle, its historian Martin Jay notes, were anxious to deny any significance at all to their ethnic roots. Felix J. Weil, for example, has heatedly rejected any suggestion that Jewishness, defined religiously, ethnically, or culturally, had any influence whatsoever on the selection of Institute members or the development of their ideas. What strikes the current observer, Jay continues, quote, is the intensity with which many of the Institute's members denied, and in some cases still deny, any meaning at all to their Jewish identities. Asterisk. Jay, while, quote, the financial sponsor of the Institute and other left-wing ventures such as the Malik Verlag, Verlag is a German word for publisher, and the Piscator Stage, he writes, quote, in more than a score of letters, Weil exhorted me to ignore the Jewish question entirely in my treatment of the Institute. To bring it up once again, he contended, would play into the hands of earlier detractors who had explained the Institute's radicalism by pointing to the cosmopolitan roots of its personnel. This would be the Nazis who chased these guys out of Germany. Martin J., Anti-Semitism in the Weimar Left, Midstream, 20, Number 1, January 1974, and that's a magazine I or you have certainly never seen anywhere. Well, maybe you have, but I've never heard of it or seen it anywhere, and I don't even recall the name Martin J. I don't think that MacDonald ever refers to him, but there's someone who's writing around the same time about these things. Martin J., Anti-Semitism in the Weimar Left, Midstream, 20, Number 1. Back to the main text. In this vehement rejection of the meaningfulness of Jewishness in their backgrounds, on the part of Frankfurt's theoretical critical theorists, because that's what they're doing, is developing a critical theory or radical critique of all institutions of society while pretending to be universalist and abstract and detached, they're actually ethnic agents pushing an ethnic agenda. In this vehement rejection of the meaningfulness of Jewishness in their backgrounds, on the part of Frankfurt's, quote, critical theorists, in this insistence on their own total assimilation, Jay argues, one cannot avoid a sense of their protesting too much. Oh, I think being a kike has a little bit to do with it, buddy. I really do. I really do. It is important to note here that, except in the case of Walter Benjamin, there was no open break by Frankfurt's circle members with their parents or with the Jewish community. On my analysis, there existed all the shame and anger at the vulgarity of the parental bourgeois materialism, as there had been in the case, for example, of Helena Deutsch, but unlike Deutsch, unlike Rosa Luxemburg, this hostility was displaced from Jewish bourgeois society to the permitted target of the larger Gentile society. So, the bigger picture, we have these Jews coming out of the East, they're scummy Galicians, and their parents' generation accedes to some degree of wealth and social acceptance, and then their kids are ashamed by that and distance themselves, but not a total break, as he says, and they come up with theories to explain what's wrong, and in those theories they target the Gentile community because that's socially acceptable, and they deny their own Jewish roots, and they deny their Jewish motivation. So that's what's going on here. As we know. Now, let's see. On page 154, just to locate ourselves. Like I said, we're only running to about 162 today. So. It is highly significant that the radicals of the Frankfurt Institute, again with the exception of Benjamin, Walter Benjamin, precisely did not carry their rejection of, quote, the commercial mentality of their parents, to use Jay's phrase, into outright personal rebellion. Of equal significance is the obverse fact. These well-to-do, business-oriented Jewish parents of the Weimar 20s and 30s did not, for their part, rebel against the radical mentality of their sons, but on the contrary, generously supported them, as affluent suburban parents were later to support their new left activist offspring in the American 60s in their higher calling. Would have been published by Marx openly and publicly in 1844, and the Jewish question would be written discreetly in 1946, 102 years later, by Horkheimer in a private letter to Leo Lowenthal. Quote, "The Jew is the pioneer of capitalism," unquote. The difference is that the Marxism of the Frankfurt Circle is a refined or bourgeois Marxism. Frankfurt Marxists, as Edward Schill's notes, S-H-I-L-S, are edel Marxisten, like noblemen of Marxism. Marx's bad taste was his insistence on saying in public things others would only say in private. He repudiated, in other words, the core differentiation of bourgeois society, that division of labor it had institutionalized as its solution to the discontents of modernity, the bifurcation of life into private and public spheres. A private solidarity with the close-knit bourgeois Jewish family, Pache Marx's revilement of bourgeois familism, was dutifully protected. The Marxian strictures of critical theory were conspicuously reserved for and publicly directed against the larger bourgeois Gentile society, where estrangement and alienation were both normal and subculturally normative, being defined as exile. There was, for example, some transient initial friction between father and son, Jay relates, when Max Horkheimer, the Frankfurt Institute's most important director, decided not to follow his father into manufacturing. Now, black quote here on Horkheimer, not following his father into manufacturing. The one real period of estrangement that did occur between them followed Horkheimer falling in love with his father's Gentile secretary, Maiden, M-A-I-D-O-N, 8 years his elder. He married her in March 1926, at about the same time that he began teaching at the university. It was apparently much harder for his parents to get used to the idea that Horkheimer was marrying a Gentile than that he was becoming a revolutionary. That's telling, isn't it? That's a good telling detail. It is the ironic fate of Marx's communism, as of Freud's psychoanalysis, that they came to employ and express the normative and cultural differences they were designed to deny and transcend. They came to stand for Jews, not for any kind of new universal scientific way of seeing the world. Quote, "Both systems, in Stanley Rothman's view, deny the reality of cultural differences, affirming instead a universal ideology applicable across cultures and across ethnic lines. What better way to end one's marginality than by undermining the categories that define one as marginal?" And boy, there could scarcely be a more relevant quote than today. And even as I write, just to locate this in time, Britain has voted to leave the European Union, and then today the Pope is all saying that the church must apologize to gays and women and everyone else that's offended. That what better way to end one's marginality than by undermining the categories that define one as marginal? It was relatively late in his intellectual life that Levi-Strauss was to settle on an intellectual tool, structuralism, that would put an end to the trauma of status loss inherent in Jewry's entry into the modernized West in the 19th century. Quote, anthropological analysis tends, admittedly, Levi-Strauss writes toward the end of Tristes Tropiques, to enhance the prestige of other societies and diminish that of our own. It's inherently relativizing, he's saying. In that respect, he concedes, its action is contradictory. To escape from this contradiction, Levi-Strauss constructs the anthropological ideology of structuralism. In this way, he tackles the contradiction inherent in the anthropological version of the paradox of skeptical fanaticism, namely, that while fiercely critical, even culturally subversive, of Western usage, mores or mores, our ways of doing things, and modern society, he became, in the face of the other, exotic and earlier cultures, uncritically accepting, whatever their defects. And certainly that would go on to the extent of lying about them and covering up things they did. At home, he writes in Tristes Tropiques, T-R-A-S-T-E-S, T-R-O-P-I-Q-U-E-S, the anthropologist, at home, he writes, the anthropologist may be a natural subversive or convinced opponent of traditional usage, but no sooner has he in focus a society different from his own than he becomes respectful of even the most conservative practices. How shall we have the right to fight these conservative abuses at home if, when they appear elsewhere, we make no move to protest? The anthropologist who is a critic at home and a conformist elsewhere is therefore in a contradictory position, since, in terms of his cultural relativism, skepticism, there can be no privileged or absolute values, which would be fanaticism. There's only one way, he concludes, going back through Marx to Rousseau. Our master and our brother, in which we can escape the contradiction. Our master and our brother would be Marx and Rousseau, in which we can escape the contradiction in the notion of the position of the anthropologist, and that is by reformulating on our own account the intellectual procedures which allowed Rousseau to move forward from the ruins left by the Discours sur l'origine de l'inégalité, the discourse on the origins of inequality, to the ample design of the social contract, of which Emile reveals the secret that everyone's molded by their education. That's what Emile was about. And social institutions are the reason people are messed up, rather than the means of civilizing them. And thus discover the unshakable basis of human society in the Neolithic age, that myth-minded age. Soon after writing Tristes Tropiques, or Tropiques, Levi-Strauss underwent a kind of conversion. The whole normative status his teacher Durkheim had given to the societies of historical, modernizing Western civilization, calling them societés supérieures, was repudiated. The tetralogy of Levi-Strauss, completed in 1971, Introduction to a Science of Mythology, seals that repudiation. In the first volume, The Raw and the Cooked, 1964, an ancient theme of diaspora intellectuality puts in its appearance, recalling Freud, Marx, and others, namely Part 2, which begins by coding Bororo, B-O-R-O-R-O, myths with high Parisian irony under the category of the Good Manners Sonata, pages 81 to 133, with a subdivision on childish civility, pages 108 to 120. Echoes of Marx and Freud can be heard in Levi-Strauss's obsession with the raw, the coarse, the vulgar, the naked, and their transformation-mediation-sublimation into the cooked, the refined, and the clothed. And I missed an asterisk on the 155. The four volumes are Volume 1, Le Cru et le Cuit, Paris, Library Plon, 1964. Volume 2, Du Miel aux Cendres, Paris, Libraire Plon, 1967, Volume 3, L'Origine des Manières de Table, Origin of Table Manners, Paris, Libraire Plon, 1968, and Volume 4, L'Homme Nu, I think that means the new man, Paris, Libraire Plon, 1971. In 1968, Levi-Strauss published the third volume of his Mythologies. It's 475, or Mythologies. Its 475 pages carry an astonishing title, The Origin of Table Manners, in French, replete with references to the De Civilita Morum Perilium of Erasmus. The volume culminates in a seventh part, Les Règles du Savoir Vivre, The Rules of Knowing How to Live, in which the Neolithic know-how of living, savoir vivre, to know, to live, which is the morality encoded in myths, is pitted against the modern Western know-how of behaving, savoir faire. So we know how to behave, but they knew how to live. If the first two volumes of his Introduction to a Science of Mythology unpack the secret logic at work in mythical thought, Levi-Strauss's third volume reveals the morality that also lies hidden in mythology. A morality, Levi-Strauss tells us, quote, as remote, alas, from our own morality as its logic is from our logic. True morality, the morality immanent in the myths of savage peoples, is based on a, quote, deference toward the universe. So we see some of this idea that they're closer to the earth and closer to the moon and stars and the universe, and more spiritually real than civilized white people. Some of this would originate in Levi-Strauss's bogus ideas, or nostrums, which originally meant snake oil. Our morality, the morality of mechanical civilization, is a code of good usage, bon usage, based on our fear of the impurity outside ourselves. Modern Western savoir-faire inverts the true order of savage savoir-vivre. We must quote at length the concluding sentences of Levi-Strauss's Origin of Table Manners, in which Sartre is made spokesman for the Western civilization the anthropologist contemns. A long block quote here. If the origin of table manners, or, to speak in a more general fashion, the origin of good usage, is to be found, as we believe we have demonstrated, in that deference toward the world which constitutes le savoir vivre, namely, to respect our obligations to it, i.e. the world, it follows that the morality immanent in myths runs exactly opposite to the ones we profess in our time. It instructs us, in any case, that our formula, hell is the others, that's Sartre, is not a philosophic presupposition, but an ethnographic testimony on a civilization. From infancy, we are socialized to be afraid of impurity coming from outside ourselves. When savage people proclaim, on the contrary, that hell is in ourselves, they offer us a lesson in modesty which one wishes we were still capable of understanding. In this century, in which man has made it his business to destroy countless living species, so many societies whose richness and variety have constituted from time immemorial his most splendid heritage, never has it been more necessary to insist, as the myths teach, that an integral humanism begins not with man, but by putting the world before life, and life before man, and respect for other beings before the love of self. Man must cease appropriating the earth as a thing, and behaving in relation to it with neither shame nor reserve. And you should be able to see that the origins, a lot of the leftist lunacy and environmentalism in that regard. I mean, it sounds good, but in reduced to reality, it's, you know, the same old anti-white civilization critical nonsense. French ethnologists and anthropologists were unprepared for such a book with such a theme bearing such a title, The Origin of Table Manners. An obsessive theme of diaspora intellectuality, morals versus manners, the hypocrisy of civility, the triviality of etiquette, surfaced once more and once again, became the target, both as fact and as symbol, for that resentment resentment harbored by emancipating Jewry against the complex code of interaction ritual which governs the, quote, relations in public, as Irving Goffman calls it, of the members of Western bourgeois society. I am often struck in American Jewish literary intellectual rights by how eager we are to reveal all sorts of ugly secrets about ourselves. We could explain the hatred we feel for our parents. We are rather pleased with the perversions to which we are prone. We seem determinedly proud to be superior to ourselves. No motive is too terrible for our inspection. Let someone hint, however, that we have bad table manners, and we fly into a rage. If we allow table manners to stand as a synecdoche for, that's using one part of a thing to represent the whole, for propriety, good usage, and civility in general, as Levi-Strauss does, the anthropologist, at this not uncommon charge against his people, did a slow burn which resulted in the magnificent origin of table manners. The work culminates with a sermon addressed to the West on the nature of true deference and demeanor, in which the rules of how to live of the so-called peuple sauvages are put into the list against the rules of how to behave of so-called civilized peoples. Levi-Strauss has managed to extract from his descriptive science of mythology a normative morality in terms of which he grades our civilization. He gives it a zero for conduct. Zéro de conduite. As early as 1959, Levi-Strauss had laid out his program for mythologiques in a discussion with Georges Charbonnier, broadcast over French radio. If, he said then, we want to understand art, religion, or law, and perhaps even cooking or the rules of politeness, we must imagine them as being codes formed by articulated signs following the pattern of linguistic communication. But of greater interest is Levi-Strauss's alleged reason for turning the relation of savage good usage and civilized good usage into a relation of hateful contraries. The criterion used is the differentiation of the Western, presumably Christian, abhorrence of l'impureté du dehors, the impurity of the outside, of natural substances coming in from the outside, de dehors, in contrast to the modesty of the savage, who is in mortal fear of contaminating nature and men with the impurity inside himself. There are two directions of defilement, then. Pollution can come from within, dedans, or from without, dehors. It is exactly here that we make a decisive discovery about the origins of the Levi-Straussian fascination with table manners and table etiquette. In one of those rare passages in which he speaks of his early youth, Levi-Strauss writes, long block quote, "My only contact with religion goes back to a stage of my childhood at which I was already an unbeliever. During the First World War, I lived with my grandfather, who was a rabbi of Versailles. His house stood next to the synagogue and was linked to it by a long inner corridor. Even to set foot in that corridor was an awesome experience. It formed an impassable frontier between the profane world and that other world, which was lacking precisely that human warmth which was the indispensable condition of my recognizing it as sacred. Except at the hours of service, the synagogue was empty. Desolation seemed natural to it, and its brief spells of occupation were neither sustained enough nor fervent enough to overcome this. They seemed merely an incongruous disturbance. Our private religious observances suffered from the same offhand quality. Only my grandfather's silent prayer before each meal reminded us children that our lives were governed by a higher order of things. That, and a printed message which hung on a long strip of paper in the dining room, 'Chew your food properly. Your digestion depends upon it.'" End of the block quote. The desolation, the absence of fervor, the incongruous disturbance are not surprising. It is the long strip of paper that arrests our attention. On it, a kind of dietary law of propriety stares down on the dining room table. A hygienic imperative instructs the children in the bon usage of eating and chewing. Moreover, the food is seen under the aspect of its potential endangerment to the digestion, if not the health of those who consume it. This is the earliest cited case in Levi-Strauss's own life of, quote, that complete inversion, unquote, he speaks of in The Origin of Table Manners, in which good manners become a hygiene of self-protection against external threat. The analysis must be pursued to its final term, the very criterion Levi-Strauss uses to castigate Western table manners and its good usage in general, is identical with that which Jesus first used in castigating the ritual purity of the Jewish Pharisees, by declaring that it is not the evil that comes into man from the outside, it's not that which goeth in the mouth that defileth a man, it's that which comes out. It's what he says that comes from his heart that defiles him, not what he eats. But that which comes from within that defiles, Jesus made the decisive break with Judaism. Thus Max Weber, and this is the only case known to me where he lays aside his Weltfreiheit, his value-freeness, writes in Ancient Judaism, block quote, precisely with regard to ritualistic, Levitical purity, even Jesus' message took quite a different course from the Essenian ethic, the monumentally impressive lordly word, not that which goeth into the mouth defileth a man, but that which cometh out of the mouth, and out of an impure heart. Matthew 15:11-18, meant that for him ethical sublimation was decisive, not the ritual surpassing of the Jewish purity laws. And the anxious segregation of the Essenes from the ritualistically impure is contrasted by his well-ascertained unconcern in having intercourse and table community with them. In the concluding passage to Levi-Strauss's masterwork, The Origin of Table Manners, we thus find ourselves in the presence of an episode of unusual significance in the intellectual culture of the diaspora. In this passage, the lesson in modesty, quote-unquote, taught by the myths, in which the great Franco-Jewish structuralist puts into the mouths of his Neolithic savages to be leveled as an indictment against Western modern Christian civilization, is identical to the monumentally impressive lordly word that Jesus first raised against the Torah of the very Judaic civilization to which Levi-Strauss, by descent, belongs. Contemporary biblical scholarship validates Weber's identification of the distinctive element in the mission of the historical Jesus. Ernst Käsemann, a post-Bultmann form critic, writes of the same text Weber refers to, Matthew 15:11-18, that, block quote, Matthew obviously thought that Jesus was only attacking the rabbinate and Pharisaism with their heightening of the demands of the Torah, but the man who denies that impurity from external sources can penetrate into man's essential being is striking at the presuppositions and plain verbal sense of the Torah and at the authority of Moses himself. For Jesus, it is the heart of man that lets impurity loose upon the world. By saying this, Jesus destroys the basis of classical demonology, which rests on the conception that man is threatened by the powers of the universe and thus at bottom fails to recognize the threat which is offered to the universe by man himself. I take that to mean that all Jews are the problem, not just the Pharisees. Levi-Strauss has, in effect, transformed the experience of religio-cultural inferiority into an incognito. In the persona of his suppositious savages, he castigates the West for, quote, habituating us from infancy, dès l'enfance, in the fear of impurity from the outside, dès dehors, much as his grandfather's dining room injunction and his rabbi grandfather's kosher laws had instructed him in the ritual fear of the impurity of certain foods. We may repeat here about Levi-Strauss what Etienne Gibson or Gilson says of his Sorbonne philosophy teacher of long ago, the idealist Leon Braunschweig, or Schwieg. What he objected to in Christianity was what it had retained of Judaism. This strain of secular Jewish Marcionism runs strong in French intellectual Jewry, from Bergson and Braunschweig, or Schweig, through Simone Weil to Levi-Strauss. Levi-Strauss's master Durkheim had written that Judaism, in fact, like all early religions, consists basically of a body of practices minutely governing all the details of life and leaving little free room for individual judgment. Jewry is innately totalitarian, that is. Levi-Strauss could perhaps live with the fact that Durkheimian modernization theory had turned his ancestral religion into a species of early religion. What he could not live with was that which Durkheim actually wrote, and which is bowdlerized from the original in the preceding standard translation. Le judaisme, en effet, comme toutes les religions intérieures. Judaism, like all religions of the interior, The essential thrust of all of the work of Levi Strauss, as much for the educated lay reader as for professional colleagues, is put in lapidary, that's gem-like, polished form, by Sante de Grammont. There are no superior societies. The essential thrust of all the work of Levi Strauss, there are no superior societies. The demeaning status implications of Western modernization theory, the place it assigned to Judaism and by implication to Jews, was the bullet Levi Strauss could not or would not bite. In common with all the classical diaspora ideologists, this fact, I believe, is what sent him A, back to the primitives, and B, up into the Platonic heaven of ahistorical structuralism. It is the conviction of Talcott Parsons, this would be like the number one WASP sociologist type, voiced at the August 19, and Talcott Parsons said at the August 1973 meeting of the American Sociological Association, ASA, that Levi Strauss's structuralism, by leaving both social structure and history behind, by analyzing the culture value system alone, the element of myth constitutes a regression from the more full-bodied theory of human action of Durkheim. The above analysis places that regression in the sociology of knowledge context of Jewish emancipation as a status ordeal. So they're very jewily trying to find some way, and these three giants, Levi Strauss, Freud, and Marx, found three different ways they could present as factual or scientific of explaining away the curious, ugly backwardness of their religion and their people. That's what all this amounts to. Except it's not just that they're being defensive and defending their own, which we would be indifferent to because who cares. It's that it becomes the basis for an all-out attack on our race, whites, who weren't backwards and ugly like the Jews. There is a respectable tradition that views great works of arts as issuing from the psychological traumata of their creators. This is the view of Edmund Wilson's Wound and the Bow, for example. Wilson was a literary critic, very prolific in the 20th century. Sociocultural wounds, it is my hypothesis, lie behind the ideological creations of the giants of the Jewish diaspora. In Freud and Marx, as we have seen, the inferior Jew loses his inferiority, and the mighty goyim are brought low. The, quote, final triumph, unquote, of the Freudian hermeneutic, the interpretation is what a hermeneutic is, that's a sort of grad school word, with its remedial reading of social delicts, mistakes, or faux pas, as medical symptoms, is its transvaluation. The final triumph of Freudian stuff is its transvaluation. The implication, Goffman tells us, that socially improper behavior can be psychologically normal, and socially proper behavior can be truly sick. The final triumph of Marxism is Marx's refusal to give a remedial and apologetic reading of the economic behavior of the Jews, describing it with unembarrassed bluntness, only to turn around and make this crude Judentum. Judentum, the German word for Judaism, had the derivative meaning of commerce, since it was associated with Le Happy Merchant, as they say. David McClellan reminds us, Marx before Marxism, New York, Harper and Row, 1970, page 141 to 142. The very stuff of Unterbau of the bourgeois civilization of the goyim. It is a failure of understanding that sees in Marx's conviction that, stripped of his sublimations and refinements, a Gentile is as avaricious as a Jew, an offense only to Jews. Stripped of his sublimations and refinements, Gentile is a Jew. He's just as greedy and dog-eat-dog as the Jews. Christianity, Marx writes, quote, overcame real Judaism only in appearance. It was too refined, too spiritual to eliminate the crudeness of practical need except by elevating it into the blue. Christianity is the sublime thought of Judaism, and Judaism is the vulgar practical application of Christianity. Asterisk. I have substituted for noble and common in the Easton and Goudat translation the words refined and vulgar, respectively, from the Robert Payne translations in Marx, New York, Simon & Schuster, 1968, page 93-95. Note that in this early formulation of the, quote, kingdom of necessity, need, from which communism will finally free us, Marx, while defining necessity as practical need, appears to accept the same goal he takes to have been Christianity's, viz., to eliminate the crudeness of practical need, emphasis on crudeness. Easton and Goudat, Writings of the Young Marx, page 247, Christianity is faulted only for having failed to attain this goal because it used the wrong means. Only by eliminating practical need as such, Marx maintains, can its crudeness be eliminated. Public impropriety, crudeness, will end only when private property is abolished. It is in this sense that Marx's socialism, as noted earlier, starts out as a sumptuary socialism. Beginning with particularist shame, it becomes in the end universalist and motivated by genuine passion for justice. Back to the text. Like the Odysseys, the sociodysseys, the social evil versus God evil, theories of evil. Like the Odysseys, the sociodysseys of the diaspora giants cope with the problem of pain, suffering, and evil. Each bestows meaning and thus solves the tsuris of galut, the problems of exile, the status loss of emancipation, the humiliations of assimilation, imitation, the embarrassment of being defined as primitive. If, as E.M. Forster said, coarseness reveals, vulgarity conceals. Freud, Marx, and Levi-Strauss struggle to redefine the post-emancipation situation in terms of the Jewish pariah, the Ostjude. He becomes, like Rousseau's natural man, an instrument of critique of the Jewish and Gentile parvenu. He may be a primitive, quote-unquote, and crude, but he is not hypocritical. Freud's ethic of honesty. A socio-cultural status humiliation of this character provides the motivation nexus, the subcultural climate and provenance, of the work of Levi-Strauss. Clifford Geertz, G-E-E-R-T-Z, in attempting to understand the dramatic transformation that took place in the work of Levi-Strauss between the personal and elegiac Tristes Tropiques, 1955, and the high science of Le Pensée Sauvage, 1962, which led into his Science of Mythology Tetralogy, four works, asks, is the transmutation science or alchemy? Is the very simple transformation which produced a general theory out of a personal disappointment real or a sleight of hand? Is Levi-Strauss writing science, Geertz concludes by asking, or is he, like some uprooted Neolithic intelligence cast away on a reservation, shuffling the debris of old traditions in a vain attempt to revivify a primitive faith whose moral beauty is still apparent, but from which both relevance and credibility have long since departed. All right, turning on to the final page. In the final chapter, finale of the final volume, 1971, of his tetralogy, L'Homme Nu, Man Nude, means nude, not new, or Naked Man, Levi-Strauss, in a moving and eloquent passage, claims that all the binary oppositions in the myths that his four volumes have disclosed and inventoried derive in the end from a fundamental generative opposition, an antinomie première, first opposition, namely that voiced by Hamlet. To be or not to be, that is the question. Again, we witness here a metaphysician of his masters, Emile Durkheim and Marcel Mauss, M-A-U-S-S. Their famous work of 1903, Some Forms of Primitive Classification, a contribution to the study of collective representations, was a kind of epistemological study of the origin of the universal fact that all peoples classify, divide, and arrange the world into categories, classes, genus, species, varieties, equivalences, binary oppositions. They found the origins of classifications, even logical and ontological ones, like being and non-being, in the social arrangements that constitute a society both within itself and vis-a-vis other peoples and societies. Here we see once more what Talcott Parsons remarked as Levi-Strauss's regression from Durkheim. By rooting all the social and natural oppositions in the primal antimony, antimony première of Hamlet's soliloquy, Levi-Strauss bids a final farewell to the stubborn empirical dimension of the social sciences, a dimension that defines and entraps man into history in its rebuking arbitrariness and humiliating reversals. By means of the universal and ahistorical idealism of the ideology of structural anthropology, the early involvement of Levi-Strauss with the fact of his Jewishness, the ancient Jewish problem, quote-unquote, has disappeared. The primal antimony, the primary donné given of the socialization of Jews in the West in the post-emancipation era, namely the primitive classification of the world into goyim and ourselves, has been swallowed up and assimilated, sublimed into the lofty binary oppositions of nature and culture, raw and cooked, night and day. Taking our cue from Levi-Strauss, who concludes with a citation from a hero of literature, Hamlet, we end this selection, or this section, with a quotation from Alexander Portnoy, not the least of whose kvetches to his parents, his complaints, concerns the primitive classification or antinomy premier they had instilled in him. Quote, "The very first distinction I learned from you, I'm sure, was not night and day or hot and cold, but goyisha and Jewish." Portnoy's complaint, I guess. And there's an asterisk there. For a remarkably convergent analysis of the role of Levi-Strauss's Jewishness in his structuralism, his transformation of marginality into a recognized and prestigious immunity, that in itself is a phrase worth remembering, transformation of marginality into a, quote, a recognized and prestigious immunity, see anthropologist Stanley Diamond's In Search of the Primitive, A Critique of Civilization, New Brunswick, New Jersey, Transaction Books, 1974, pages 321 to 331. That was a lot of stuff I read when I was a teenager to get my base of knowledge. Transaction Books did a lot of fairly good social criticism. The book was published after the above was written. So, Levi-Strauss has yet a third way of saying that there's nothing wrong with Jews. The problem is with you or with everybody. And that ends chapter 18 and also part 2. That was by itself freestanding. And next we'll be hearing about Jews and Irish, latecomers to modernity, and other more recent stuff. It's kind of an odd mix of some of the things he has in here, but he packs a lot into a comparatively few pages. But as I said, the size of these is somewhat bigger than the average book, and the type is somewhat smaller. So anyway, very instructive. Claude Levi-Strauss, that chapter. Thanks for being with me today. You can find everything we do at vnnforum.com, and I'll be back with you again real soon.